The House Labor and Commerce Committee meeting to order, and let the record reflect that the time is 2:15, and the date is April 30th, 2005, Saturday. Members present, Representatives Crawford, Guttenberg, Lynn, and myself, Chairman Anderson, we do have a quorum, and I believe the other three members are en route. Today, we will have House Bill 271, 286, and then Senate Bills 137 and 158, and Representative Wilson is here to join us for House Bill 271, Limit Overtime for Registered Nurses. Representative Roper has joined us. Welcome, Peggy. And go ahead and present your bill.
Okay. My House Bill does just what it says. It outlaws, you might say, mandatory overtime for nurses. And the reason is because mandatory overtime causes significant problems for both patients and healthcare workers. Forcing nurses to work beyond their regularly scheduled shift has been linked to increased error rates in providing patient care. It's also increased injury rates for both patients and healthcare workers. And among the healthcare workers, the abuse of mandatory overtime has also been associated with unhealthy weight gain, increased use of alcohol and tobacco, and also lower levels of functional ability to perform for job performance. For nurses, these errors or mistakes can cause life-threatening situations for both the patient and the nurse, from back injuries to medication errors to increased blood pressure and even client deaths. With these mistakes and errors, there's also the chance of lawsuits with loss of license and increases in malpractice insurance rates. Evidence is very strong that prolonged work hours and fatigue affect worker performance. And actually, the United States Department of Health and Human Resources authorized the Institute of Medicine to study nurse work hours and healthcare errors. And the study showed provided compelling evidence that nurses working long hours has an adverse effect on patient safety. I'm not going to go into the whole study, but I'm just going to bring out a couple things that I think was really important. The study actually estimates that between 44,000 and 98,000 hospital deaths can be attributed to medical errors each year. Now, mandatory overtime is a serious contributing factor to some of these errors. The final recommendation of the study was that all overtime, voluntary or mandatory, involuntary, should be curtailed totally. That the overtime, whether they want it or whether they don't, should be stopped. The risk of making an error was actually three times higher when nurses had to work shifts that were longer than 12 hours. And working overtime increased the odds of making at least one error, regardless of how long the shift was originally scheduled. And that about 12% of the absences were reported by Randall's sample of Canadian staff nurses was found to have a direct correlation to overtime working. So mandatory overtime is one of the main reasons nurses are leaving the nursing profession. In the face of a severe nursing shortage, we need to keep nurses at the bedside, and they're choosing to leave now just because of their frustration. Surveys have shown that the exodus of registered nurses, therapists, technologists, technicians, and service and maintenance workers is directly attributable to difficult working conditions, including inadequate staffing, mandatory overtime, and insufficient compensation. So this legislation will not prohibit nurses from working overtime. You know, if a nurse feels that she's capable of working another 4 hours or another shift, she could well do that. But it will discourage an employee from assigning mandatory overtime and will prohibit an employer from threatening or retaliating against a nurse who refuses this overtime. This bill will allow a professional nurse who is providing patient care to make the decision on whether they are safe to practice or not. 10 states have already enacted legislation prohibiting mandatory overtime, and another 20 are in the works of doing that. This is not really an overtime issue, however. This is a safety issue for both patients and nurses. And with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions.
Thanks, Representative Wilson. Representative Loon has one, but I had a quick question just regarding the fiscal note. It states here, and I just wanted to get that on the record, that the costs anticipated for this would be $59,900 for salary and benefits and $14,300 for associated position costs for a wage and hour investigator one. And I assume that's because there's 5,000 plus nurses, and that would be covering the state's nurse capacity and infringements on the law. And then it raises up a little bit, but that seems to be the okay, Representative Lynn.
Yes. What happens in an emergency situation, or say you put out a fair schedule, but then one of the other nurses becomes sick, nobody's volunteering? Can you do mandatory in that situation?
Well, there's actually five exemptions, and that's one of them.
Okay. Would you be able to tell me what the five exemptions are?
If there's an unforeseen emergency situation that comes up that, you know, no one could handle, you know, they
proceed.
Yeah, that would be one. Also, a nurse that is on call. So in other words, lots of times nurses, for instance, when I worked at the hospital in Wrangell, we were on call certain nights. So I know I might have worked the shift, but I was on call in case their emergency came up and they needed somebody.
Yeah, my daughter in Indiana, actually North Dakota, is on call right now for nursing today.
And
I'm going to interrupt you real quick, Representative Wilson. For the members' edification, it's page 2, lines 14 through 20 are the five exemptions.
Right.
So
okay.
She can read them into the record. You can also read them.
And then a third one is a nurse voluntarily working overtime. And number 4 would be the first hour of on the overtime status while the hospital is trying to find somebody else to work during that time. And then also this does not apply to critical access hospitals. And the reason being is those hospitals are kind of in areas where there's not other nurses available. I mean, they're very limited. Like they're on islands or, you know, Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, Cordova, in areas where there's not a lot of other available nurses. So.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Roachberg?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for pointing that out. Representative Wilson, the subsection 3 exception, adverse voluntarily working overtime, do you see that as problematic in terms of what's voluntary and what's not? I mean, I can envision some problem.
Through the chair, Representative Roachberg, typically what happens is that if a nurse all at once calls in and she's sick, the nurse, the head chief of staff or whoever would come to you and say, the next shift isn't covered. Would anybody volunteer to take that shift? And if I'm working and I've got an 8-hour shift, I might say to her, you know, I'll volunteer for the next 4 hours. I can't handle the full shift, but I'll do 4 hours if you can find somebody else to do the other 4 hours. So there are, as long as it's voluntarily, that nurse probably knows whether she can handle a few more hours or not.
Right, and just put one follow-up.
Hey, Representative Roper.
Did you, you indicated in the backup there's other states that have adopted this. Is this bill based on another state statutory construction? Or?
Yes, some of it was pulled from other statutes across the United States.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, just for the record, Representative Cott and Ledoux have joined us as well. We have a full committee today. Any other questions for the sponsor?
Please. Representative Cott, perhaps you could tell us who else is here to testify.
Yeah, we have three more folks. Rebecca Bowling from the Alaska Nurses Association on an off-net. Gray Mitchell is here for questions from the Department of Labor. And then we have in Anchorage, Kathleen Geddes, Providence Registered Nurse, and on the bargaining unit of ANA. And then Diane O'Connell, Alaska Nurses Association, and Lonnie Hosley self. And I'm going to ask them because we have a lot of bills. Okay. Okay. If you want to mark your name there. So why don't we go to Rebecca first, and I'm asking all of you, I'm going to be strict on this one because we have three other bills and a lot of people, full audience today. 3 minutes is your time limit. So go ahead, Rebecca.
Good afternoon, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for scheduling this bill on Saturday and for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Rebecca Bowling, and I am a registered nurse in Ketchikan. I am also the president of the Alaska Nurses Association, which represents over 6,000 registered nurses in our state. And I'm calling in today to offer my support of House Bill 279. I know you're already aware of the severity of the nursing shortage, not only in this state, but all across the country. And while we have experienced shortages on and off throughout the decades, this shortage is certainly of greater proportions than any other nursing shortage we've experienced, and we expect it to get much worse. There are many reasons for this, as you may already be aware, such things as the need for increasing numbers of nurses to care for the growing elderly population, fewer individuals choosing a nursing career, and most importantly, the growing trend of nurses who are leaving the profession or planning to leave the profession. It's been identified by many surveys of nurses that as many as 20% are planning to leave the profession in the next 5 days, or the next 5 years.
We're in trouble. We're in big trouble.
According to many studies and surveys in recent years, nurses are leaving the profession primarily because of working conditions, and one of the working conditions they cite as a top reason for dissatisfaction with their job is mandatory overtime. Mandatory overtime hours are those hours that are worked above and beyond whatever was predetermined as their regular scheduled shift, and that employee makes it compulsory as opposed to voluntary. Failure to comply with an employer's demand for mandatory overtime can result in the threat of job loss, discipline, demotion, or a host of other retaliative measures. These kind of working conditions are just the kind that run nursing professionals like myself away from the bedside, away from the hospital, and in many cases, out of the profession entirely. And maybe more importantly, mandatory overtime has also been associated with poor health of the nurse and most certainly causes family, marital, and child care problems. It is no wonder we're seeing an exodus of nurses in many healthcare settings, particularly ones that use mandatory overtime as a means to deal with inadequate staffing and nursing shortages. Moreover, mandatory overtime contributes to poor quality of care, mistakes, and errors, which can and do have disastrous effects on our patients, as Peggy Wilson has so clearly pointed out. The answer to the nursing shortage is not mandatory overtime. Mandatory overtime will worsen the nursing shortage by driving more and more professional nurses away. Other states have grappled with this issue as well and have now completed or initiated steps towards legislation to restrict mandatory overtime for RNs, LPNs, and in some cases, other healthcare workers. Nurses do suffer retaliation from employers for refusing overtime hours, and there are reports from this from all over the country, which is why legislation banning mandatory overtime for registered nurses is so important. So on behalf of more than 6,000 nurses in the state, I do applaud your efforts to protect the profession of nursing in Alaska and the safety of our patients by moving forward on House Bill 271. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. I'm going to change my requirement for 3 minutes to two, only because I think Rebecca generally testifies on behalf of the Alaska Nurses Association, hence she's somewhat part of the sponsorship of this. And I will open the questions up to Rebecca, and then because folks keep piling on to testify on this, I'm going to limit it to 2 minutes per person, because my guess is it's going to be duplicative. So Representative Guttenberg, a question for Rebecca.
Thank you. Ms. Bowling, how do you see this applying to nurses doing administrative work as compared with direct care?
I wouldn't think that it would apply to nurses doing administrative work, primarily because those are like contracted services. I mean, you're not paid on an hourly wage, for example. And nurses who are staff nurses are paid on an hourly wage, and those are the ones that are affected by mandatory overtime. A salaried employee, like an administrative person, isn't going to be subject to overtime pay or overtime regulations.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Ledoux?
I noticed that in this bill, this doesn't apply to a critical access hospital, and I'm not sure what a critical access hospital is.
Rebecca?
I'm not really sure. I think maybe Peggy could maybe answer that.
Okay. Peggy, Representative Wilson?
That definition, or through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it is defined in the bill, and that's on page 2, line 27. Oops, Well, anyway, I was thinking it doesn't say in there. Okay, what it is, it's hospitals that are in areas when they say critical access, it means that those are areas where there's, oh, let me see. I want to make sure I say this right. Areas of hospitals that where the hospital is, they don't have all of the you know, I'm afraid to say it because I'm sure I'll say it wrong.
Don't be scared, Josh. Please console her.
I think there's only five hospitals, or maybe four hospitals in the state that are critical access hospitals. One is Wrangell, one is Petersburg, one is Cordova. And those are hospitals that are really in kind of in trouble because where they're at, their populations have gone down, and so they've gotten special help from the state, I think, in order to keep giving the services that are there.
I wonder if there's any place we could get a copy of 42.
It's in the statute.
USC.
Yeah.
Federal law.
They get extra help from at the federal level to keep the hospital in those areas because if the hospitals weren't there, there would be no access to health care.
Is that something your staff could supplement as we go through
yes.
that? Because I know the next committee of referrals, HESS, which you plan to work on over the summer, assuming this bill passes out of committee, Representative Ledoux.
Yes, I'm just worried about, you know, where there is a hospital that perhaps has a limited number of employees, that's probably going to be the hospital that's most likely going to force unwanted overtime on people. And by exempting those hospitals, aren't you kind of undoing a lot of good that this bill is meant to do?
Well, through the chair, those areas, there aren't other nurses available there. I mean, like, you know, in a lot of areas, the nurses are there. In fact, when I talked with the Nurses Association and talked with the nurses, actually most hospitals, I don't think there's any hospitals in this state that are actually making people work overtime except API, some of the Pioneer homes and like in corrections. So it's happening in those areas.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, well, next go to, why don't we go here in the audience. Okay, we'll take a brief at ease. They're having a technical problem with the teleconference. Okay, zip it, please. And now let's go to Dave Williams.
I missed that one. That's cool.
Thank you. My name is Dave Williams. I'm here for the Pioneer Homes and Veterans Home, Department of Health and Social Services. And what I want to say is that RNs are, I'm going to call registered nurses RNs. RNs are really important to us because we cannot work without them. They're essential to what we do. And what goes on in the Pioneer Homes, you are not allowed by law to do a lot of what we do unless it's under the supervision of an RN. So we do a great deal of our professional level work using certified nurse assistants, but you just have to have an RN on the floor. If we didn't do that, we would have a violation of licensure laws. Wouldn't have the skills and training that it takes to do the work either. We've heard about the nationwide shortage of RNs already, and I know you recognize that. We do have difficulty finding RNs to even interview for all of our shifts and our locations. We have six different homes to staff. So when we're short, we do, as Representative Wilson had indicated, we ask if somebody's willing to work. So we look for volunteers first, and that, my impression from working here in Juneau, is that out in the homes, we generally are satisfied by asking for volunteers, but not always. In general, I think also that the RNs who work for us have endearment to the residents that they serve, and so when it comes time when somebody's not showing up or is unable to come to work, that they generally will volunteer. I think under the bill, though, we do have at times when we have to ask people to stay, and it would be called mandatory overtime. I think under the bill, we would probably have to pay a whole lot more attention to making sure that we ask whether that's voluntary or mandatory up front, so we have that recorded in some way. I do not have my work done yet to give you a fiscal note, but I should be able to do that by next week. I need to check with each of the administrators and get a sense of what's voluntary and what's mandatory. For the mandatory part, if we were no longer able to say, and again, I'll say RNs are really important to us, so the asking them to work mandatory, we sure don't want to lose more RNs. But if we do have to do that, and we're not able to do that, I think we'd have to look for an alternative somehow to staff. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do the business we do. Generally, the only thing that comes to mind is contract nursing, which is already being used quite a bit. So there's some competition for contract nurses as well. And I just say that to give out some information about what I think would be our possibility. We would probably look at that. Though I haven't done the work yet, I think we'd probably look at that in the fiscal note to see what contract nursing, because you can get nurses that way still. I'd say from outside of my work, I'm also involved here locally, and notice that in the local area here, contract nurses now are being hired from Canada. And so we are looking for, they're not easy to find either. It's really, I guess the impression I wanted to give you up front and at the end of this is the nationwide shortages of RNs is really a challenge for us, and I don't know what would make that better. So that's a question.
Okay. Representative Rettenberg?
Is that the, thank you, Mr. Williams, is that the, one of the major problems you're having with RNs and the shortages, is it salaries and benefits? Is it just not enough trained people in the state of Alaska?
I can't really speak to that through the chair. I really can't speak to that today about whether it's what's causing the shortage. I think it's that we're, as was said earlier, we're not seeing the people choose that as their line of work. To some extent, I'd have to say if we were to pay more and more, of course it would attract more people, but the shortage is, I think it's been said before, it's such a shortage. We're still going to have a hard time finding RNs.
Do you know what the compensation difference is between the state and the private sector?
I don't.
Okay, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any numbers on what what might be the average amount of overtime that a RN would work in your facilities today?
I don't. I can get that, though, and I intend to put that into the fiscal note analysis. I have raw data, but I have not had a chance to work it or to I need to define what's voluntary and what's mandatory.
Well, just to combine the both of them, how much overtime, how many hours is an RN working today, whether it's mandatory or voluntary? That's my question.
I need to have some time to get back to you on that. I have information on overtime hours, but I need to have the rest of the non-overtime hours in order to give that to you.
Dave, if you could have those questions maybe in correspondence, then as the bill moves to the next committee, and again, Representative Wilson plans to, and I hope folks recognize that on teleconference, not to take too much time if you support the bill, because we're going to try to get it out of this committee and keep it in Hess over the summer so she can work on answering those questions. So if you could correspond to us too, that would be great.
All right.
Thanks. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I've written a note here that it looks like I know Kathleen wants to go into a little more substance on the bill, and then the rest of you, if you don't have anything to add, if you could just let us know who you're affiliated with and you support it, we can get to dialogue on the bill itself. So Kathleen Geddes, you're next.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Geddes, and I'm a registered nurse on the Progressive Care Unit at Providence Alaska Medical Center. I serve as the president of the Providence Registered Nurses Bargaining Unit and delegate to the American Nurses Association. The American Nurses Association and the Alaska Nurses Association remains very concerned about the impact of mandatory overtime on the ability of the nation's nurses to provide high-quality health services. The American Nurses Association and the Alaska Nurses Association believe that the elimination of mandatory overtime for the nation's nurses is a critical success factor in efforts to improve the quality of health care and improve conditions for nurses. The American Nurses Association and the Alaska Nurses Association oppose the use of mandatory overtime as a staffing tool. Today, overtime, whether it's voluntary or mandatory, is the most common method facilities use to cover the staffing insufficiencies. In fact, some employers have described mandatory overtime as a staffing model and have actually coined the term mandation to define the methodology. Mandatory overtime were central issues in major RN strikes in Washington, D.C., Minnesota, Ohio, New York, and Hawaii. Mandatory overtime, as has been previously illustrated, puts patients and nurses at risk for medical errors, as well as driving registered nurses out of the profession. Strictly limiting mandatory overtime for nurses is a critical step in improving the quality of health care and reducing medical errors. As Peggy pointed out, as many as 98,000 hospitalized Americans die each year as a result of errors. A study conducted by Health Affairs in July of 2004 examined the use of extended work shifts and overtime as hospitals cope with the severe nursing shortage. The report revealed long hours when hospital staff nurses worked 12 or more hours resulted in both errors and near errors in patient care. The likelihood of making an error was three times higher when nurses worked shifts lasting 12.5 hours or more. Working overtime increased the odds of making at least one error, regardless of how long the shift was originally scheduled. Working more than 40 hours per week and more than 50 hours per week significantly increased the risk of making errors. And I want you to also realize that the study proved that error was usually made when the nurse's shift actually exceeded 8.5 hours. Unlike many industries where public safety is a concern, healthcare is exempt from regulations which limit the use of overtime as a staffing tool. There currently exist government standards that limit the hours of pilots, flight attendants, truck drivers, and railroad engineers can safely work before consumer safety is endangered. However, no similar limitations exist for our nation's nurses who are caring for patients. Although this testimony is via telephone and I cannot see your faces, sooner or later, either myself or a colleague will see your face when you become a patient or have a loved one who is hospitalized. Think to yourself, if I don't want a pilot flying a plane for more than 12 hours, why would you want a nurse to care for you when long working hours have clearly illustrated the likelihood of medical errors occurring? API has been and is at a disadvantage in recruiting nurses secondary to working conditions and below average salaries. However, API cannot stop accepting patients and cannot deny hospitalizations. Private hospitals can divert if there's a lack of staffing. Let me stress the fact that API has lost numerous nurses. Combination of mandatory overtime and working short has left nurses with no other option than to seek other employment opportunities.
Kathleen, could you conclude your testimony?
This is my last sentence.
Okay.
I urge Alaskan legislators to set new state limits on the ability of health facilities to require mandatory overtime from nurses. Mandatory overtime is unethical. I urge the Alaskan legislators to be responsive to their constituents concerning the unethical use. Nurses care for you and your loved ones 24 hours a day. I ask you, who cares for nurses? Help retain, recruit nurses, and provide safe patient care by prohibiting mandatory overtime in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Rookford.
With apologies to the chairman of the committee, Ms. Geddes.
Yes, sir.
You indicated you're part of the Providence Bargaining Unit. How does your labor agreement deal with the issue of mandatory overtime in that facility?
Our contract, we are covered. They don't use mandatory overtime. We're covered by our collective bargaining agreement. However, we do have situations that occur. Let's just say in the OR, you're in the middle of a case and the case goes long, maybe a coronary artery bypass graft. You start your shift and it has to extend into 10, 12, or 13 hours. That does occur. But we have a large pool of nurses, and Providence makes every effort to find someone to take your place. They also have a large pool to pull from to seek volunteers.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thanks, Kathleen. We'll go next to Diane O'Connell.
I will be very... I'll be brief. I just wanted to indicate that we have been working very closely with Representative Wilson's office on this piece of legislation, but we have also been working with nurses represented by several different labor organizations. The Laborers Local 341 represent the nurses at Regional Hospital in Anchorage, and they've been very helpful in helping us develop some of this language. Also, the Teamsters that represent nurses at Kodiak and Homer, and of course, the Alaska State Employees Association, who are the collective bargaining agent for API nurses and nurses employed by the state in prisons and youth detention facilities and other facilities. Nurses throughout the state are very, very concerned about this issue, whether it has affected them personally yet or not. We're working together. We are very pleased to have had this opportunity to talk with you this afternoon, and we urge your support for House Bill 271. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. O'Connell. Are there any questions? Seeing, hearing none, we'll go next to Lonnie Hosley and then wrap it up with Carol Widman.
Hi, my name is Lonnie Hosley. I'm a registered nurse, and I currently work at API. I've been a nurse for over 20 years and am very familiar with what my peers have stated and fully agree with them. I am in hopes that you will follow through with House Bill 271. I am deeply in favor of it, and I thank you for the opportunity of speaking.
Thank you, Lonnie. Appreciate that. And so you work at API?
Yes, I do.
How is the new gymnasium's hardwood floor that Cott's Hardwood Flooring put on? That's Cott's Hardwood Flooring, 465. No. Thanks, Lonnie, for your testimony. Okay, we'll go next to Carol Widman.
Hi, I'm Carol Widman, and I'm also a nurse at API, and I have been forced numerous times to do mandatory overtime, and I really hope you guys pass this bill, because it's very dangerous for patients, and that's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks for your brevity. So you support the bill. We appreciate you standing by to testify. I don't see anyone else in the audience. I know Gray has always kind of come to these meetings, but doesn't look like we have a question. Okay, oh, we do. Great. Quick question, and then we'll close public testimony. Bill? Sorry, I thought I...
That's okay. Gray Mitchell, Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Go ahead, Representative Gutman.
On enforcement, it says on page 3, line 10 of complaint, alleged violation chapter must be filed within 30 days. Then the commissioner must provide a copy of the complaint to the healthcare facility naming the filing within 3 business days. What happens if there's a failure to file that within 3 business days? Who does that fall onto?
You need to get back to him on that one? No.
Well, I would... my guess would be that that would be the department's failure, and the case would not be pursuable then at that point through the chair. I mean, that's what it appears based on the plain language.
Representative Roper?
Just to clarify, Ms. Gray, there was testimony that the healthcare, Mr. Mitchell, healthcare workers are exempt from the last wage and hour act. Is that correct, or how is that? Do you recall what that is?
Through the chair, there is an exemption for most healthcare employees. It's basically those employees that are employed by a hospital who provide medical services to patients in the hospital are exempt. It doesn't include administrative type employees, nurses, and such.
It would include clinics or doctor's offices?
Through the chair, no. It's only overnight hospitals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Seeing no other questions for... Great, thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify online or in the audience? Seeing, hearing none, we'll close the public hearing portion of the bill. Is there any dialogue from the committee? Representative Guttenberg?
Oh, I'm not going to slow it up, but just Representative Wilson, that's something to look at. Just a procedural question.
Okay.
3 days.
And she just for the record, she passed out that definition that was requested in writing, so you should all have a copy of that. Any other questions for the sponsor or dialogue? Representative Cott?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I had the same concern that Representative Guttenberg had, and I'm not sure, and it was his best guess, Ms. Mitchell's guess, but I think we need to be somewhat clear on the disposition of that. If it's a failure from the department's side, not to notify the facility, I'm not so sure that then would restrict that complaint from going further. I could see some opportunity for misgivings there. Also, Mr. Chairman, and I'm certainly not going to hold this bill up, but we'll get another opportunity to see it, I believe, in judiciary since there are some fines and fees associated with it. But I think, in at least with the state facilities, the Pioneer Homes, if they're found to be not in compliance, then the penalty, that fine, that is going to be forthcoming. It seems to me we're taking it from them, which they receive from the general fund, and I assume we're depositing it back in the general fund, but that's not clear in the bill where that deposit is going to be made. Is it going to be kept by the Department of Labor? Is it going to go into the general fund? Or what's the disposition of that? So I'd ask the sponsor during the course of the summer to visit that particular issue. I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that was all the comments I had. But I think it's a serious problem around the state. And if this addresses it, then go for it.
Okay. Seeing no other questions or comments, could I have a motion to move the bill to HES Committee? Representative Ledoux?
I'll move House Bill number 271 out of committee with attached fiscal note and notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Hearing, seeing no objections, so moved. Thank you, Representative Wilson. And Gray, only 10 more days, and then you guys won't have to be drug in on sunny Saturdays.
Gray workers comp. You come to my office.
Yeah, right. Okay, House Bill 286, Representative Samuels has been patiently waiting. He promised this would be a fairly easy one.
Not. Okay. Only 2 pages.
Yeah, that's right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Ralph Samuels, representative from District 29. This HB 286 is a housekeeping bill that was brought forward by Municipal Light and Power, dealing with a method for determining the royalty received by the state in a particular instance. DNR calculates the royalty value based on a contract between MLNP and Shell. MLNP then bought this interest in the Beluga River field from Shell, and DNR agreed to let the rate go as if the contract were still in place. That contract expires in 2005, and what this legislation would do, it would allow DNR to use the gas transfer price set by the RCA, much like DNR used the contract price for the gas. Transfer price is the rate MLNP basically charges itself interdepartment-wise for the Beluga field gas that it uses. So it's a technical change, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I'm going to assume that Jim Posey from MLNP, Marie Crosley from DNR, and Kate Jard from the RCA can probably explain it and answer the questions within their testimony.
And so far, Representative Samuels, I have Jim Posey, Martin Schultz, Andy Lyman, and Dan Helmick, and that's it. So hopefully those other...
I'm here.
Oh, who is that speaking?
Kate Guyard.
Oh, hey, Karen. Okay, hi, Kate. Good. So Kate's on board, too. So let's, I'm going to just defer to the next person because I know that Representative Samuels is just facilitating the bill and doesn't have the background on it. So, Jim Posey, welcome. Jim, are you online?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson and all the representatives. What this does, as Representative Samuels said, is a housekeeping bill which allows a matrix of calculations for the price of that we pay royalty on to be first done through the RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and if that rate is sufficient for royalty purposes, then it passes on as mustard for the DNR. If the DNR at some time says that later on down the road, several years, that that royalty value is lower, then we go to a second matrix, which is through the DNR process, which would allow us to establish a royalty for the gas that we use to run our turbines. And other than that, it's just like Representative Samuels said, it's a housekeeping bill that separates the two to keep competing state agencies from having jurisdiction concurrently.
Thank you, Mr. Posey. Are there any questions for Jim? Hearing none, then why don't we go to Kate, and then we'll bounce back to Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I'm available for questions. I have the RCA has reviewed the statutory revision, and it is in keeping with our understanding of our responsibilities in terms of opining on the transfer price on an annual basis. There is no additional cost to the RCA from this legislation because it's part of the process that we ordered in U-96-36, which was a docket that we had opened when MLMP purchased the Beluga field. And order number 39, which if legislators wish I can send to them, describes the methods for calculating.
Okay, thanks. Kate, are there any questions, Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, just if, could you just explain briefly to the committee the formula that you did in the oil and gas yesterday?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Roper, the formula is actually shown, and one of the reasons I thought that order would be helpful to you is the formula is shown on an exhibit to the order, and it is actual cost of production less sales that they do multiplied by a margin that we calculated as 1.6. It's their debt service coverage ratio. So the calculations are based on their actual production costs.
Thank you.
Kate, you bet. Thank you, Kate. We'll go next to Martin Schultz from Division of Oil and Gas.
Yes, good afternoon. Through the chair, my name is Martin Schultz. I'm the audit manager at the Division of Oil and Gas, and I would just like to state that the DNR does support the bill. Basically, what we do to determine royalty value under state leases is we look either at the contract price that the producer actually gets for its gas, or we look at what other producers in the same area get for their gas. And it's called the so-called higher of comparison, where the state is entitled to the higher of those two values. What Alaska Statute 38.05.180AA does is it basically allows a producer that sells to a gas or electric utility to get royalty value certainty in that if DNR approves, the value that is used is what they actually sell the gas for under their contract. This bill, in other words, and then the bill or the statute gives up the so-called higher of value, the value that other producers receive. What this bill would do is expand the coverage of 180AA to include a transfer price that a producer gets on gas deliveries to an affiliated gas or electric utility. So it's consistent with the current statute, and DNR does support the bill.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Are there any questions for Mr. Schultz? Seeing, hearing none. Andy Lyman, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, and Dan Helmick, do you have anything to add, or are you supportive since you're with Municipal Light and Power under Jim? Are you good?
This is Andy Lyman. Freeman, Kemal Huffman Ellis, we're regulatory counsel for MLNP, and Dan Helmick from MLNP is here. And yes, we support the bill, and I think everyone else has adequately covered matters unless there are any additional questions from the committee.
Thanks, gentlemen. Okay, then is there anyone else that wishes to testify in this very dynamic and exciting bill that have given all of us goosebumps? I'm kidding. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 286 with individual recommendations and any attached special note or notes.
Okay, is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved, and I'm sorry it took so long.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
5 minutes, that's a record. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, and ladies. Okay, next we'll go to Senate Bill 137. You know the drill.
It's just the victim out of here. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 137 has a few changes.
Do we need adopt the work? Okay. Then if I could have a motion, Representative Kahn, to adopt the G version.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt the G version, Senate Bill 137, for discussion purposes.
Seeing no objections, so adopted for discussion purposes.
Yeah. Yeah. In your file.
Chair.
G version, right?
Bill.
Does everyone have a copy? Should we take
no.
What version?
It's the F version.
F.
I have the F.
Oh.
Let me have one.
Well, then I'm going to take an at ease, and I'm going to check. So an at ease real quick. Which version? For me.
For a motion.
Objection. Objection from me to adopt, okay. Not wanting to adopt
Mr.
the
Chairman,
G version.
Mr. Chairman, in view of the objection to adopt version G, I've got ahead of myself. I would move then that we adopt the committee substitute Senate Bill 137 version F. 42705 Kurtz.
Okay.
There's the working document.
No objection. It's before us.
Go ahead. Thank you, Chairman. My name is Joe Michels, legislative aide to Senator Ralph Seekins. To outline the changes that address some of the concerns that members of the committee had, we removed the word institution from the title and inside the bill itself and just designated the University of Alaska. And we took it one step further to outline student housing versus just a residence to really designate the dorms, the student housing versus, you know, somebody who's living on campus in some other capacity, a maintenance worker, a professor. So we just tried to specify student housing as much as possible. Those are the two changes to the bill from when you the committee saw it last.
Okay. Are there any questions, Representative Wren?
So the nursing home and the hospital, that's all out of there?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Roper?
I guess looking at the title and looking at the act, and they seem to be a little bit at odds when it's just maybe the syntax of it, because it's in the title it says now, an act providing University of Alaska may evict a tenant from student housing that is exempt from the provisions of the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act without resorting to court proceedings under AS09 da 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 da. But then down below in the bill, there's nothing, I mean, that those are the rules of civil procedure in Alaska for real estate. But then down below it says nothing in the civil rules of procedure shall be interpreted to require, which I agree with, but then the title doesn't seem to be the same thing as the bill. I don't know, it's the drafting thing.
I would just state for the record.
Maybe our lawyer here could help us, Gabriel.
No, I can't. Okay.
Well, I think that it's correct, and I think Jean Michelle wouldn't have made that mistake, but should she have, and with the limited time we have, if someone has a major.
But this, well, what bothers me, it says without resorting to court proceedings under civil procedure. It says in the title, which you have to get somebody evicted, you have to go to the civil procedures. It's okay not to, you don't use when you do like a unlawful detainer. You know that's part of the civil procedures, but. That doesn't mean it's not part of the landlord-tenant.
Well, how about this? What if we were to strike on page, well, it's only one page, page one, line three, after act, delete that without resorting to court proceedings under, would that be more?
Well, I know what they did. They left it the same because then we'd have to have a title change.
I think that's what happened, too. But
no, we got a title change. Yeah, we do have a title change.
We did that from the last time you were here. I mean, isn't version F different?
It's just bad syntax. I'm not going to make a big deal out of it. It's a better, improved bill, but it just doesn't seem to make sense.
Next.
Okay.
Does it go?
Yep.
Yeah, have a look at that title. It says without resorting to the proceedings. Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
Okay,
I hope you understand what I'm saying there. Because it says in the title one thing, and I think it says in the bill now another, just the way it's expressed. With that, I'll shut up.
No, we always enjoy your thoughts, yeah. But in this case, it's sunny out. In this case,
it's windy, too.
That's right. Okay, are there any other questions or concerns? I think you'll relay that to Representative Seekins, and we can address that. And it may be still proper or maybe adequate as written, but we'll find out. Representative Ledoux.
So I guess I'm just trying to find out is, you've got a student and you want to evict him without going through a formal eviction procedure. How do you do it then?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there is a long appeals process, a review process when they're removing the student from housing. The main goal of this bill is to, once that process is over with, they can remove the student. They usually just change the locks is what they do, but they don't have to go to court to get a court order to have the people forcibly removed.
Cousin Vinny.
So they change the locks and then the things inside. Well, Limp Bizkit posters and others, and then they lose. Representative Ledoux.
Go ahead.
Because in the case that you showed me, they didn't exactly go to court, to get him evicted. They called the state troopers or the police or something like that on him, and the court simply dismissed the misdemeanor complaint against the person that was filed. And I guess I don't have any problem with moving this bill, but I'm not entirely sure that you're going to solve the problem that you may want to solve with it. I'm not sure that you'd have, even if this were in effect, you'd probably, if you were still going to do it that way, you'd probably still have a court say that somebody couldn't be convicted of a criminal offense without some sort of due process rights. So they just point that out.
Thank you.
Okay. You can relay that. Senator Seekins, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with the bill because I think Representative Ledoux is correct, too. That case law was basically a criminal statute, and that's where the judge threw it out. It wasn't based on whether it was landlord-tenant law, the way I read the case. But anyway, nevertheless, the problem under the landlord-tenant law is you have to have, if it's not for rent, you got to go through like 30 days or there's to mitigate the situation. I guess I still don't understand the title of the bill. It says you don't have to go to civil procedures. It looks like the title to me doesn't fit the body of the bill. The body of the bill says you're not required, the university won't be required to use the Landlord-Tenant Act. I still don't know how you get the guy out of there. I don't know how you don't put an exemption from the civil procedures in the title of a bill.
What I'd like to do, Labor and
this
Commerce,
is a judiciary problem.
This was assigned to Labor and Commerce because of the landlord-tenant aspect of commerce. And I think we all concur, unless I'm wrong or mistaken, in the concept. And there may be a problem with the title. As we pass it out to judiciary, you might want to relay it to legal services and make sure that it's good to go. So when we bring it up in LISO's committee, that or we'll fix it there on the title. So he understands that. Can I have a motion to move the bill out of committee? Representative Cox.
Mr. Chairman, I move then that we move House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 137 out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Okay. Hearing no objection with the recommendation to check on the title, so moved. Thanks. Okay, our last bill is
Okay, what Eddie's. And now the final bill of the day with patient Senator Huggins, who we had to bump because we didn't have a meeting yesterday, along with Senator Seekins' bill, is Senate Bill 158. Welcome, Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today on Senate Bill 158. I need to admit to you up front that this is I'm representing a special interest today. So just make sure you understand that. The special interest are the citizens of the state of Alaska, because this essentially will maintain what most of us think is common practice and common sense in the state, and that is this. And let me just talk through scenarios so you see which way we could be headed, and that's the easiest way for me to explain it to you, and probably, if you're like I, that you get your arms around it quicker that way. We go to a community. We have a project, a state project, on an airport for $8 million. And in the process of that, one of the contracting groups, a subcontractor, on a $400,000 piece of that, is subjected to a 5% sales tax on the $400,000 contract. That was not the practice when, I'm told, that's not the practice when they bid on the contract, but ultimately, before they got out of town, they paid $21,900 on that contract. I think you will find, as I did, when this was first mentioned to me as a chair of transportation, I sort of tucked it away and said, well, maybe I'm closed-minded about how things should be. So for about a month, as I traveled through the state, in particular through airports, people I didn't know would ask them. And I just share with them the same sort of scenario. And to the person, they said it was about like this. You know, that's not right. Because how much money does the community need to get from us? I mean, we, in good intention, send $8 million, and so we need another $20,000 out of that. So with that, we offered this bill. Now let me offer up a couple of things that this bill does not do. The first one, this bill does not preclude the equipment that might be leased in that locale from being subjected to a tax. People that are there working as part of the project, if they stay in a motel or if they go down and eat, they're taxed. If they buy supplies and things of that nature, they're taxed. Doesn't normal sorts of things that you and I would expect. This isn't about rural. It isn't about urban. It's about how we do business. Now you say, well, what would that cost us? Well, I can tell you, on a normal year, we have about $350 to $450 million worth of construction contracts. If we don't take action kind of like 158 describes, essentially it will create, number one, an unstable environment, because if you don't believe me, I'll tell you there's an AML email, which they gave to me, but it kind of lays out that this is a business practice done under advisement of a legal firm, and it goes like this. I think most communities that use blank law firm have a policy of collecting sales tax from subcontractors doing business in their community regardless of the funding source. So it's essentially a business practice. The other thing that I discovered when doing a little background on this is when you talk to different people in the state agencies, it was foggy at best about what the state's position was and how it was delineated as far as taxing authority and things of that nature. 158 clears that up, gives a predictable business environment, allows us to go out and do business as most of us would expect. Mr. Chair, your questions.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. I was just looking at the letter from Noam. I had a question, and I wondered, I've made a little research on this and investigated, and we've talked how many other communities are affected. It looks like it's de minimis and minimal at best, but it obviously, and you're aware, it clearly adversely affects the city of Nome. And I wonder,
you've got iPowered advocates on both sides, I realize, so they probably already follow this, but just for the record, is there any way to grandfather in current infrastructure where there's taxes, or does that defeat the purpose, in your opinion? I mean, is that why you, I just thought, because it seems to devastate.
I'll leave that to the committee today as far as the determining, you know, in your body, but I just got to tell you, in talking to average Alaskans out there, that, I mean, how much is enough? You go to a community, we do cut there, and how much, and oh, by the way, it can be very, very varied about the communities. This will drive up the cost of contracting. It will cost us Alaskans more money. So if we want to buy into that and we want to create what some would characterize a revenue sharing based on contracting, then you support that course of action. My answer in scenarios where we're going out to enhance that community, that to reach out and carve money out of that and drive up the price of contracting is not right.
Questions, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions here. But one, just give me an example of what it was that cost them the $21,000. What was the contract for? Was it for labor, for materials?
No, it was an electrical contract. The total contract to do the electrical work, in this case, I try not to use the community's name, but on a community, it was $400,000 in the macro. The locale there says, you came in here with a $400,000 contract, you owe us 5% of that. They didn't say we want to know about if you went down and bought bulbs or conduits or things of that nature. Say, you owe us in the macro 5%. You know, I think most of us in a common sense would say that's just not right.
Representative Crawford?
And you partially got into the next part of it. Say I had a fence contract at an airport, and I miscalculated by 5,000 feet of fence, and I went and bought that 5,000 feet of fence.